You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Michael Scoggins. Michael, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Michael, are you in New York now? Is that where I'm calling you?
In Brooklyn, yes.
In Brooklyn. And what are you working on at the moment?
I'm currently prepping for a show that's not until next year at a gallery I work with in Vienna, Ernst Hilger Gallery. So I'm currently getting prepped for that.
And by getting prepped, I mean you're putting together ideas for that show, or what exactly?
Yeah, putting together ideas right now, just kind of in the sketchbook, writing out some stuff and drawing out thumbnails and whatnot, but also constructing the base of what my drawings are, the notebook format that I've been working on for a long time now. So I'm just drawing lines and cutting holes, basically, and creating these surfaces that will eventually have whatever's going into the sketchbook kind of put on top of that.
And so let's talk about the process a little bit, because it's really fascinating and of course very different to see in person in one way than on the internet, because when we look at it, I mean, just to visualize this for people, when we look at what looks like a page ripped out of a notebook with a drawing on it, you know, a kind of standard spiral-bound notebook, on the internet it looks like a page ripped out of a standard notebook, but obviously it's a huge piece, which when you see one, you know, has a quite different feeling. So how is it that, you know, those translate? Right now you are just working in a notebook. Is that what you're saying? I mean, it's as in order to prepare for those large canvases?
Yeah, it varies. I mean, I do work in aligned, like 8.5 by 11, the spiral mount notebooks that you buy, you know, in a drugstore. But I also have other sketchbooks too, where I just kind of like journals where I write and kind of work out ideas. And, you know, there'll be different versions of a piece that the piece will end up being. So there could be, you know, you'll see the final piece, which is, you know, a large, enlarged sheet of notebook paper. But there might be 5 or 6 versions of that in the sketchbook before I kind of settle on, you know, the one idea that kind of works and fits. So yeah,
what do you do with that one idea? How is that produced?
It just kind of comes together over time. You know, it's whatever I'm researching out the ideas. A lot of my work is, you know, using pop culture images, but also kind of this underlying political narrative that's happening. We live in very exciting political times, so I have a lot of fodder to use. So that's been kind of exciting. But then coming at it from this very kind of naive perspective, this Michael S. persona that I've created, so he can kind of do and say things that the adult version, myself, might be a little more hesitant to do. That childish.
Right. Well, let's talk about that, and just so the viewers understand, Michael S. is how you know, the work is signed. That's the series that we're talking about, which looks like pages ripped out of a spiral-bound notebook. But you're saying, which is really interesting, because I saw at least one of these ninjas, you know, in person, but what you're saying is that it kind of, because of the format, and that never struck me before, you have the latitude to kind of do whatever content you want about anything. Michael S. does, who's like this student almost, right, who's in, I don't know.
Yeah, when I first started, you know, I was kind of a shy person, especially when I was starting these in grad school. So using this persona, this Michael S., he was, you know, he was unfiltered, he was uninhibited. I think over time, as I've gotten, you know, as I've grown and have gotten more confident in my own work, I think the Michael S. character and myself have kind of grown closer together. But I still think he's definitely kind of like necessary to kind of present these ideas through a more wide-eyed perspective, rather than kind of, you know, an adult view that's kind of maybe a little bit hardened over time. So you can tackle.
Well, of course, yes. Yeah. Well, at the very least, the adult view is kind of burdened with a certain kind of knowledge, information, and experience, which which Michael S. isn't.
Exactly. So he can say, like, and he also, sometimes he will take, like, the opposite point of view that I might have in, you know, in my adult life. Like, he really loves guns, and he might be very much in favor of that when the piece is actually kind of, it could be like an anti-gun piece or commentary on gun control or something. But, you know, a lot of it's kind of tongue-in-cheek in many ways as well. Like,
right. He could be a big Trump supporter or something.
Exactly. I mean, he's like he's been indoctrinated into American culture and society, the political machine. He's, you know, encouraged to pledge the flag and revels in this kind of militaristic endeavors that, you know, that our country takes. You know, being a child of the 80s, there was a lot of that going on in the Reagan and Bush years, the Cold War, you know, I'm a Cold War baby. So that had a huge impact on me as a kid. And, yeah, I mean, war was sold to us as, like, this courageous, brave thing, when, in fact, it's a very ugly, dirty business. So, but yeah, Michael S. can take on kind of the opposite points of views that I hold myself.
So that character really has, I mean, Michael S. has been growing. I like the way you described it as coming, you know, closer together with yourself in a kind of autobiographical way, I imagine you're talking. But the character, kind of like a novel, is also being, like, fleshed out. It's getting richer in all these ways. I would think it's something like a book, which most artists don't work with so directly, but this kind of character, this, I don't know, muse, so to speak.
Yeah, I think so, and I think he has matured over the years as well, which has been kind of fascinating. As I've grown as a person, he's also kind of grown maybe closer together in similar ways, but also in opposite directions. Like, I think he's also become more emboldened in his points of views, which, like I said, might not be my own. So I think a lot of the pieces have actually gotten more outspoken in what they're trying to talk about. You know, if he might be a big Trump supporter, as you said earlier, and be very outspoken about that, which is kind of frightening.
Which is wonderful, because you could do anything with that, right? I mean, as much as, you know, I'm horrified by Trump, that's a pretty dynamic energy to be able to engage, because if there's anything, Trump is kind of virtuosic at it, getting pressed. Right?
Yeah. it's an interesting process for sure, and I kind of, it's funny, like, when I'll have openings or receptions or something, and there's a crowd around some of the work, and, you know, I think most people kind of get the kind of tongue-in-cheek nature of it, but sometimes there's that one person that will come along and be like, yeah, I love guns too, you know, that's awesome, and I'm like, whoa, you're not really getting this, so you have to think about it a little bit further and kind of get the irony that I'm kind of getting at, and that's always kind of, I find it humorous, but also kind of disturbing at the same time. So, war, you know, let's do this.
Right. So, but that's an interesting thing to have to respond to when someone comes up and says, yeah, guns, man. And you have to say, no, I meant guns were for idiots. I didn't mean that.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't, what do you say? I mean, that's a pretty delicate thing to get used, misunderstood irony.
Unlike Michael S., I'm very diplomatic in my responses, so I try to be very, I try to explain things very casually and very kind of thoroughly, and like, no, this is what I'm trying to talk about, you know, talking about this particular incident or issue or bill that was just passed, you know, in Congress or something, and just kind of basically overload them with the facts of the issue, and hopefully, you know, they don't take offense. So, I try to be a little more measured, I guess, in my responses. So.
And in the show that you're preparing for, can you talk at all about the content or ideas that you're dealing with there? Is it a lot about politics? And can we talk about that? Is it too early to talk about that?
Sure. I mean, I think it is very much in the early planning stages. But I think it's going to get a lot. It's going to be a lot of imagery, but also a lot of text, kind of combined. I think it is going to be a very political show. It's, like I said, it's going to be in Austria, and the audience over there tends to really kind of enjoy and dig into the political work a lot more than the American audience, I would say. And I'm actually planning, and this is still really early on, to actually add some paint element to it, which I haven't done in a long, long time. I primarily use just pencils and markers and things. So I'm going to use some very rudimentary painting techniques to kind of get to produce some of the imagery. But that's really early on, and it could be a complete and utter failure. We'll see. I haven't painted in a long time. So I'm kind of excited and kind of anxious to get started on it. We will see what happens.
Well, as you're saying, also in Europe, too, I mean, I tend to find, I mean, maybe this is my projection, too, but I interview a lot of people in Europe, artists and different people, and there seems to be a more critical view of capitalism in general in Europe, whereas here, that's not an issue that artists are often grappling with, you know? I mean, guns are, or politics, but, I mean, or I don't know, yeah, or politics, certainly, but... in Europe,
I would agree.
There seems to be more critique, which is so. In a sense, is that part of what you're designing this for? Because I mean, and just correct me if you perceive it differently, but it seems to me in Europe there's a little more of an examined take on all of those things.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the work itself that I'm contemplating and getting ready to work on, I think is more the natural progression of just the studio practice. This work was going to happen one way or the other. But it just so happened that it was going to coincide with this exhibition. And it's going to coincide with this exhibition where the audience will be maybe a little bit more thoughtful about these things. So it's just kind of happenstance. I've been kind of building up to this for a while now. It was just, just luck that everything seems to be kind of syncing together at the same time. But once again, it's all going to be an experiment. I'm not going to get too far ahead of myself there.
Well, right, because in the same, it's interesting that you keep saying that, but I suppose that's also kind of the ethos, if that makes sense, of how they're created. You're not planning a body of work the way someone would who's, let's say, Neo Geo or whatever, an artist sticking to a particular code of rules. Do you know what I mean? Or no?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, with this format that I've created for myself, and I've been working on it, I guess, since around 2001, 2002, so it's been a while now, like this notebook format. The idea is everything is, it's a format that is the same every time. I'm creating the exact same sheet of paper that could be torn out of the same notebook, and that's how I've kind of always viewed it. So I have this format that's very recognizable and kind of gets to the core of what people, they see it, they instantly recognize it. It's an instant relation, which is kind of, I don't like the word hook, but it is. It's kind of like the hook that brings it.
Oh, it is. No, that's true. I mean, go on, but we related immediately to when we were, I do anyway, to when I was 15, writing in a notebook in school.
Yeah, exactly. But what can go on top of that, is infinite. There are infinite possibilities, and I really kind of love that I have something that is recognizable, but what can go on top of that is potentially anything. There's no barring to what my imagination can come up with, and that's kind of that's why I've been doing it for so long, because it just kind of can keep evolving and changing. And the last few years I've been primarily working on really heavy, dense text pieces with a lot of graphite and very little color. And now I'm kind of shifting gears and kind of moving back into more colorful pieces. And so it's just kind of the ebb and flow of how things are, going in my life and my studio practice. It's kind of a freeing thing, but yet still in the confines of like this format that I've created. So I see it as the best of both worlds.
Well, it sounds like it, because, to really compare that with the world, so now you are an adult, and you're a practicing artist, and you're operating within the confines of the art world, more or less. We understand what you're making, and you're able to show it. How does it regularly enter the art world, I guess, is a kind of one of the last questions. Like, you're having this show coming up. Is there also a show in New York, and are people seeing it through your studio or other ways? Like, how often does the work get into the culture, so to speak, or how does it?
Yeah, I'm constantly showing. I mean, it seems like, I mean, I just had a show, actually, we just took down, it was a two-person show that my wife and I did together, which was an opportunity that we don't get to show together very often, out in Edmana Contemporary in New Jersey. So we had a two-person show there that was up for several months. And that was a heavily text-based show because her work is also very text-based. So, yeah, I'm always kind of showing. There's, you know, group shows here and there. There's the whole art fair thing, which is a whole other, you know, we could talk another 2 hours about the art fairs and how that's affected everything. But, yeah, so there's constant views and eyeballs on the work, you know, just through social media and the Internet, which, you know, I use quite often just to kind of get people to see what's going on in the studio and just little snippets here and there. So there's you know, there's many, many ways, many avenues to view the work these days.
So then just to kind of wrap it into, you know, maybe something about the art fairs. Now you're not teaching, you're showing and selling all the time. That's how you survive.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I've been fortunate enough to be a full-time studio artist, since grad school. I kind of was able to start showing early on and hit the ground running. And, I always joke with people, I have to keep going because otherwise I'm not really qualified for any other job at this point. So, just gonna keep moving as long as I can. So, but it's definitely been, a good time. And it is nice.
Looking back at it, I mean, now that's been, you know, like over 10 years, when you look back on that kind of coming right from school and showing in galleries and having as active career as you can, I mean, how do you account for that? Does it seem like it was just, you know, you were in the right place at the right time, or were you also pursuing it in a certain way? I mean, is there anything that you've gleaned from that in hindsight of what you were doing right that you might not have realized then?
I mean, honestly, back then I was just kind of flying by the seat of my pants. I didn't really know what I was doing. Right. I was in grad school in Savannah, Georgia, which is like far away from everything else. I was lucky to have some really good professors at the time that kind of steered me to kind of send some, you know, just portfolios. There were slides back then, just slides to certain galleries that might be interested. And it just worked really hard and got some nibbles early on, and things started to snowball. I think, you know, during that time period, it was when, you know, getting back to the art fairs, that's when Miami Basel was just starting. So it was kind of a different animal back then. And I got a lot of people interested back in those days down in Miami, like the first or second year, I believe. And that's kind of when other show offers, you know, not only collectors started seeing the work, but other galleries started seeing the work. And I started getting show offers from all over, kind of in one big swoop, and then they just kept coming. So,
but that's because you were showing with another gallery in Miami, you mean, at the fair?
Yeah, at that time I was working with a gallery in Atlanta called Saltworks, and they had gone down, and I think they did the very first Scope Fair, which was, I think, the first satellite fair back then. And and I just got a lot of people coming in and seeing the work. I mean, I think, you know, the Miami, all the art fairs have changed so much now. It's become so much larger. But I think back then, you know, it was still exciting and fresh. So people were still kind of there to actually see work where, you know, I think it's evolved from that. But, so maybe it was timing somewhat. But, you know, once those opportunities started popping up, I started jumping on them and started, you know, I definitely had to put the time and work in. And still doing it to this day. So there you have it.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, it's admirable, you know. I mean, because I talk to so many different artists, and it's always things, you know, work out for everybody in so many different ways and in different time periods. So it's really interesting how that came together for you and continues to. And let's see, before we go, I wanted to ask you one last question, which I've been asking everybody. Which is there a book you're reading now that you'd want to share with us? Doesn't have to be on topic at all. Could be really awesome. On whatever you want.
I'm actually reading, and this is a project of my own. I do a lot of, like I said, I use a lot of pop culture iconography in my work, and I'm a huge Star Wars nerd, and that pops up in my work a lot. I'm actually reading attempting to read the entire line of Star Wars novels from start to finish in chronological order. So I'm not very far into it, but I've just completed the first novel that came out right after the original movie, I think in 1979 or 78, I believe. So I'm reading all of the Star Wars novels because when Disney purchased Lucasfilms, all those novels used to be considered part of canon, which I always thought was kind of cool, this expanded universe that I, you know, have grown to love over the years and has been part of my life from, you know, very early on. All of that canon was considered not canon, I think that upset a lot of people, but I had never read them as in my youth, so now I'm taking the time to go back through and read through them. I have this this weird love-hate thing with George Lucas. he created all these amazing things that I hold near and dear to my heart, but at the same time, he kind of stunted my imagination because he thought of all these cool things and I didn't have to. So that's kind of what I'm in the process of doing right now.
That's really interesting material to mention, because in a way, what it's making me think of is, you know, your work. We're talking about like a time frame almost of high school or something, when people are using the kind of notebook, you know, iconography that you're using, and now this kind of material too is also in that frame of thinking, perhaps. And you know, just as you said before, you kind of have the best of both worlds, that book and other things. And just, I mean, again, correct me if this is wrong, but it does seem that you're kind of embracing the sort of endless youth culture that is your own, like, nostalgia at one point, but you're doing it not so much as doesn't seem so dark or sad, but as a way of actually re-experiencing it, right? You're getting into these books, you're getting into these ideas. It's not a kind of critique of that era, so to speak.
Yeah, I think it's just feeding.
Does that sound convoluted? Tell me if it does, if I'm not making sense. But I'm just saying things are having fun as well.
I think it is both. Yeah, it is both. And I think, you know, kind of embracing the whole, like, nerd culture, you know, it's always been, that's my background. That's kind of where I'm coming from. You know, along with Star Wars books, you know, I still read comic books and things like that and still really enjoy them. And I think, but they also do kind of feed into the work as well, at least one part of the work. I will say that, you know, the one novel that I'm currently reading is, you know, it's before Luke Skywalker and Princess Leia were brother and sister, before anyone knew. So there's some really, like, awkward scenes in these novels where they're like, even since I'm already in the know, I'm like, whoa, back off. That's your sister, dude. You know, so those moments
great.
Are kind of funny. So it's like this awkwardness that happens, and I don't know, it just kind of makes me laugh because, I mean, not incest by any means, but there's like so much awkwardness that comes with all that in that youth. So it's kind of funny.
Michael, I want to wish you the best on your upcoming show, and thank you for talking with me today.
Hey, thank you so much. I had a great time.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.